Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Gospel according to St. Matthew, the second chapter, verses 1 through 12, the very famous story of the coming of the three wise men, the three magi, to Bethlehem to seek out the newborn king of the Jews. It's a fascinating kind of passage in the scripture because, well, the Gospels, actually, they never make anything up out of thin air. There's always some kind of foundation in reality to whatever they say. But obviously, this is a very carefully constructed story, and one in which it is futile to try and extract the fundamental historical details from the construction of the story as it comes forth to us in the Gospel of Matthew. And there's so many pieces to this that it gives us a great deal to reflect on and a great deal to think about and pray over as we ponder the Gospels of this kind of most wonderful time of the year. And the Gospel begins, after Jesus had been born at Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod, some wise men came to Jerusalem from the east, and they asked, "Where is the infant king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose and have come to do him homage." When the king heard this, he was greatly perturbed, and so was the whole of Jerusalem. And he called together all the chief priests and the scribes of the people and inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. "At Bethlehem in Judea," they told him, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, you are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you will come a leader who will shepherd my people Israel." So stop there for a minute and kind of begin to look and take the story apart where it is. First of all, the whole choice of the magi or the wise men or whoever, the various kind of titles and so forth that we've given them over the years. If we are to take this and put it back into the time, what we find is that those who were the astrologers of the ancient Middle East were mainly the Zoroastrians from Iran. And Zoroastrianism was kind of a monotheistic religion, and basically worshiping the heavenly bodies, particularly the sun. And the part of their whole priestly life was studying the heavens. So if this is popularly known and well known, then it certainly presents a tremendous and a credible location for the three men in the story. And note, too, that it doesn't say there's only three of them, but they bring three gifts, and so it's considered to be probable there were three of them, which later on, of course, take on names and many other things. But it's interesting because they followed a star. They said, "We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to do him homage." So there was some portents in the heavens that they determined indicated a great event. And what the connection really was, you know, most of the commentaries say, well, there was no connection between Iran and Palestine in those early days. But we really don't know those kinds of things. For instance, even there's a great deal of speculation that the philosopher Plato was familiar with the book of Genesis. We don't know what communications were like then, and it's not outrageous to think that the peoples of the vast Middle East had some knowledge of one another, despite the fact that Palestine was kind of a small and insignificant place. It was a unique place, nonetheless, and it had a magnificent temple, so that it could very well have been kind of on the radar screen of many civilizations throughout the Middle East. At any rate, that's not something that you or I can figure out, but it's just not completely outrageous. So they then have discerned that the newborn king of the Jews, in other words, for the Jews, this meant the Messiah, had been born. And so they come and they naturally, as distant travelers, they go to the court of the king to ask, thinking, of course, that the king would, first of all, have knowledge of this, and secondly, would be overjoyed to know that that which Israel had expected, the one who Israel had expected, had actually arrived. And so they ask Herod. And the gospel tells us Herod was greatly distressed, or greatly disturbed, greatly perturbed, and with him all of Jerusalem. So why would that be? Why, in fact, if there had been a strong element within Judaism which had expected the Messiah, and then this strange phenomenon takes place where astrologers from the far away in the lands of Persia have come to find this Messiah and to offer him the royal gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. The structure of the story is really interesting because it's pointing out something very, very important. It's pointing out the fact that the Gentiles were more sensitive to the portents of God in the heavens and to the events of God's promises than were those to whom those promises had been given and who should have been prepared through the reading of the prophets. In fact, King Herod himself, he knew what this meant. And so that's why he called together the chief priests and the scribes. And where was the Messiah? Where was the Christ to be born? He has come to realize it from the testimony of the Gentiles that the Messiah has arrived in Israel. And rather than it be a time of rejoicing, Herod himself becomes greatly perturbed. And because if in fact the Messiah has come, then that means that the reign of Herod is compromised. His absolute power over the people of Palestine is going to be diminished because a figure greater than he has arrived on the scene. And you know, if we take this not in the extreme of the king and the Messiah, but if we take this and we analyze it and we reflect upon it in relationship to the life of Christians, we might want to ask ourselves, how many will be overjoyed at the second coming of the Christ? How many look forward to the return of the Lord and the establishment then of the eternal kingdom? How many do, or how many feel threatened by that because they've kind of carved out a little life for themselves in this passing world, and they don't want it disturbed and upset, and they have all sorts of connections and values to it that they want to hang on for a while. They want to, you know, they want to get their business on its feet. They want to see their grandchildren. They want to do all those kinds of things. It's not so extraordinary that the gospel says all of Jerusalem was perturbed by this. People have a very hard time thinking that God breaking into history and altering the security of the status quo is something very few people honestly look forward to and embrace. And that's something for us to reflect upon. That's something for us to think about. How are we in relationship to the promise of the second coming of the Lord? And would we be greatly perturbed along with all of Jerusalem and King Herod because we didn't want our lives turned upside down, we didn't want our lives disturbed? And so he calls in the chief priests and the scribes. He asks where the Messiah is to be born. He knows exactly what this means. And they then, quoting the prophet Micah, telling him it is in Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, and which is by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you will come a leader who will shepherd my people Israel. The proclamation, the prophecy of where the Messiah is to come from. There's a few things in this Bethlehemic story. First of all, we have, under strange circumstances, gotten Jesus, Mary, and Joseph from Nazareth into Bethlehem, which is the city of David, if we remember. It is where David, Jesse, and his family, and the youngest boy David, have come from. And so it is an intentional linking of the birth of the Messiah to the Davidic origins in Judea, in the city of Bethlehem. There's some other things in this story, too, which is probably in the back of Matthew's mind, because Matthew is kind of, it's important to him to show the similarities between Jesus and Moses. And here, Moses, born of Hebrew parents in a strange land, under a wicked king, who, in order to protect his power and so forth, decides to kill all the Hebrew males. In this decision, then Moses, once he's rescued and grows up, realizing who he really is, has to flee into a foreign land, as Jesus and Mary and Joseph are to flee into Egypt and so forth. So there is a Mosaic theme through here. And I think it's important for us in our prayer and our reflection to realize that the evangelists are expanding the identity of the Messiah so that it flows very deeply into the events of the Old Testament. And we have seen this through the whole Christmas, Advent and Christmas cycle. The Old Testament plays an underlying role in every drama that we have encountered ever since the first Sunday of Advent. And it leads us to understand that what had been revealed to the people of Israel is now revealed fully in the New Testament. And so the New Testament becomes the interpretive tool of the Old. For the Old, according to Catholic thought, the Old is standing on its own, incomplete, until the fulfillment of that which they anticipated and waiting for had taken place. I know Pope Benedict had said this, and of course immediately he was accused of anti-Semitism. But he's not anti-Semitic, and certainly, and we have also seen on the road to Emmaus that Jesus did the same thing, and I think it would be very difficult to call Jesus anti-Semitic. At any rate, so Herod then calls the wise men to himself, and he asks the exact date on which the star had appeared and had sent them to Bethlehem. And then he said, go and find out all about this child. And when you have found him, let me know, so that I too may go and do him homage. The absolute cynicism and the absolute duplicity of Herod has a great deal to do with revealing the hypocrisy, in many ways, of many Christians as well. Because these characters in the Gospels, these Gospel stories, as we've said before, they are not just stories locked into the first century. They are the story of the old, I suppose, in the English literature thing, you can call them the stories of every man. It is the story of the church always, and the story of the world always. And so once we take these Gospels apart, and once we analyze the structure of these Gospels and what they really mean and the depth of their meaning, those can just be overlaid upon any time and any place, because what we see is an image, a template of the interaction between God and humanity, which goes on in every place and every time. And it, in so doing, it reveals to us not only the truth of the past, but also the truth of the present. And just as it does not only reveal God to us, it reveals also us to ourselves. For it opens wide the mystery and the chaos of the human heart. And it helps us to realize and to understand the struggle with faith that goes on in believers, the limitations of their willingness to step into the mystery of God, and their hesitation, therefore, to take everything that the Lord has revealed to us as something to be desired and something to be sought and something to be looked for. So that here we find now, can we see ourselves, our contemporary church, in this particular situation? We don't want to know sometimes what the Lord has said to us because it becomes too difficult for us, too problematic for us. I know there's a very famous hierarchical German theologian who in relationship to some of the words, exact words of Jesus out of the New Testament, who say, "Oh well, we can't. Those were too harsh. Those were in another time." As Judd Herod, sitting on his throne, say, "You know, where is this man? Because he disturbs. He tends to disturb my world, my life, my times, my desires, my place." This is not just a glance deep into the past. And also, who are these magi in this story? Why is it important that they came from far away? Why is it important that they had no previous connection with Israel? And the answer is clear, that certainly as the faith begins to crumble through over-familiarity and indifference in heavily evangelized areas of the world, it seems new and exciting in many parts of the world. The church in Africa is exploding, and the church in Asia is exploding, while the church in Europe and North America is crumbling in many ways. And it is the same story, if we want to wonder about this whole thing in Jerusalem and Herod and so forth. Well, just think about today. How many people want Jesus Christ to burst into modern society and the modern world beyond our control? We find this in many segments of the church, that we will not bend to the Word of God and to the Spirit of God and to the presence of the living God among us, which is a huge privilege and a huge wonder. We will rebuild it and reconstruct it our way, and that goes all the way up and down the whole layers of the church throughout the world. But here now, Herod has become absolutely cynical, absolutely duplicitous, and absolutely hypocritical, revealing his true character. For he was a man who did wicked things. So having listened to what the king had to say, they set out. And there in front of them was the star they had seen rising, and it went forward and halted over the place where the child was. The star is oftentimes a sign of the liberation of Israel. As a matter of fact, in 135 AD, during the Great Revolution, against the Roman Empire, was led by Bar Kokhba, the son of the star. And the star was seen as a sign of freedom, as a sign of liberation from the oppression of the Roman Empire. And here, the oppression of the unbelief of much of the leadership of the Old Covenant. The star was therefore a sign of liberation and of freedom. The sight of the star filled them with delight, and going into the house they saw the child with his mother Mary, and falling to their knees they did him homage. Then opening their treasures they offered him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. But they were warned in a dream not to go back to Herod and to return to their own country by a different route. So here in this particular translation that I'm using, it said they're falling to their knees and they did him homage. Other translations say they worshipped him. And Matthew would probably be more likely to favor the word worship, simply because he is very intent throughout the gospel of emphasizing the divinity of the Christ, the divinity of Jesus. And so to do homage, you can do homage to a king, you worship a god. And so probably the word is worship. And as a matter of fact, in most translations, I believe that it is. So what happens then is they begin to follow this sign of freedom, this sign of the liberation of people from the heavy yoke of what Paul is to begin to call the heavy yoke of the law. The heavy, top-heavy, burdensome structures of ancient Judaism. and kind of the heel of the king and the chief priests and the scribes and so forth. So it is really a significant breaking out of not the old covenant, because breaking out of the old covenant was joyful. We see that in the story of the visitation and the leaping of the last prophet of the old covenant, John the Baptist, in the womb of his mother, at the encounter with the Messiah. So it is not a wrenching away of the old covenant. There is a harmonious flow in the revelation of God to his people from the viewpoint of the revealing Lord. But from the viewpoint of historical structures and cultures, there is going to be kind of a radical rupture. We find, for instance, this becoming a constant and perplexing issue within the contemporary church and in the interpretation of the Second Vatican Council. We have those who say that it was a rupture, and that somehow, as I heard one sister proclaim one time, a whole new church is born. Well, if the whole new church is born, then it's not the Church of Jesus Christ, which was came into being in the apostolic age with Jesus commissioning the apostles. And so what it would be that we were following would be kind of a faint image of the truth of what we were. It's the same way in saying that there was a radical rupture between the Old Testament and the New Testament. No, there isn't. There is a flowing consistency, and the New Testament authors are very clear to show that consistency. How many times in the Gospels over these last few weeks have we found connectivity to the Old Testament, connectivity to the prophets? Here we have mosaic images as Jesus is encountering similar circumstances to Moses himself, the great leader of the Hebrew people, and so forth. That without the Old Testament, the New Testament fails to convey its deepest messages. And without the New Testament, the Old Testament fails to convey its deepest messages. There is a consistency, there is a smooth flowing from the Old. And that's why the image of the visitation is so important, because that is the scriptural image of the encounter between the Old Covenant and the New. And it is very clear in that it is a joyful occasion. And that in many ways, then, the passing over is a passing over in love and care and joy and happiness. And so here, too, what we find the agents of rupture are, of course, the recalcitrant leaders of the Hebrew people, Herod, the chief priests, and the scribes, the ones who kind of have the people of Israel under their heel. Controlling them with minutiae and with what is it, 636 laws they had to obey every single day and so forth. And that the star appearing in this gospel as a sign of revolution, as a sign of freedom, as a sign of change, is not the sign of the destruction of the old covenant, but the destruction of the incrustations of the old covenant, which had begun to obscure the presence of the Lord among the people, have began to obscure the love of God for his people and the care that he has shown them forever by turning it into a very highly controlled political organization which is oriented toward keeping in power those people who had cooperated and collaborated with the Roman Empire. So this then, as we began to see, the star, the sign of freedom and liberation, rests over the place where the child is and where Mary is with the child. It's interesting in this gospel. they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they don't mention the presence of St. Joseph at all, which is unusual, except for the fact that Mary is part of the transition from the old covenant to the new, And Joseph, as the great man that he was not part of that mysterious transfer that came with the virginal conception of the child and the encounter with the old covenant in the womb of Elizabeth. And so then, falling to their knees, they did him homage, they worshipped him. So that what happens now, the Gentiles are the ones who recognize Christ as Lord. They recognize Christ in some way as God. Otherwise, they would not fall down on their knees and worship him. Once again, what the leaders of the Hebrew people knew and resented, the Gentiles discover and react according to the truth of their discovery. Once again, take this story and lay it over the whole story of God's people. Not only were the ancient Israelites unfaithful to the Spirit, the dynamic of the covenant, but so too were the people of the new. And while it's easy and fair game in many ways for people to cast aspersions upon the hierarchy of the church for being, you know, reincarnations of the chief priests and the scribes, that's not exactly the whole story by a long shot. I think we have to look how many of the laity, how many of the faithful have rejected the whole spirit of Jesus Christ, who have decided that they will create their own expression, their own form of Christianity, that they will take charge of the messianic message, that they will find Jesus' sayings too harsh, and so they have to be mitigated and changed, that decided, well, he didn't really mean what he said, and that the life of the early Christians was just kind of a thing locked in time, and that, you know, we're much more sophisticated than that in the modern age, and so we have a right to reconstruct Catholicism any way we want to, and say that, you know, it is the Spirit of the Lord that's moving it. We think about that, and then go back and read this gospel again. This is not a gospel about just the past. It is a commentary on every age and every place where the faithful live, for it is a commentary on the foibles of human nature and the consequences of those foibles when they are left free to reign, when they are not confessed, when they are not repented of, and when they become part simply of a prideful stand against the kingdom of God present among us and against the Lord living among us and being present to us in the Blessed Sacrament.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. Then